The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, you are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Messer along with Tim Stenovek. And you're going to love this next guest. You're going to be like, can I ask a question? Can I ask a question? Because we have someone who spent her life. John, you can do anything. A really cool guest who spent, two decades as a CIA agent and is writing about it.
Yeah, she's so good at disguising herself that she once made her way into the Oval Office to meet President George H.W. Bush, the whole while pretending to be someone else. There was a reason she pulled this stunt. She was chief of disguise in the CIA's Office of Technical Service, and she was accompanying Judge William Webster, then the CIA director, to show off the new disguise capabilities of the CIA.
Yeah, it's just one of the stories featured in her new book. I have to say, we've been talking about it in a lead up to this. The book is entitled In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked. Jonna Mendez spent more than 25 years as a CIA officer working all over the world, including in Moscow, Pakistan, Hong Kong, and more. She joins us from Reston, Virginia. Jonna, we are delighted to have you here with us. We were talking about the one time you disguised yourself making your way into the Oval Office to meet with George H.W. Bush, the whole time pretending to be someone else. We kicked it off there. Tell us about this stunt, first of all. We wanted to start there and why you were doing this.
Well, it's one of my favorite moments, so I'm always happy to talk about it. I was chief of disguise. We had been working for years to come up with a totally animated mask, a mask that would actually work, that would you could talk, you could laugh, you could smile. And we got there, and the very first mask that was made was an African-American man, and it was made for me to demonstrate to various people. And it was good. So I took it to my office director, and he loved it. And he said, we're going to take it to the director of CIA, Bill Webster. And he loved it. And he said, we're going to the White House. And I said, I don't know if the Secret Service is going to let me through, because I look good, but I don't sound like a man. I don't walk like a man. So we did another one. I turned into another quite different looking woman. We went to the White House. We went for the morning meeting. Brent Scowcroft, Bob Gates, John Sununu. It was a good crowd. It was a quality crowd. And I was the first one that morning to brief the president. He had been director of the CIA previously in another life. And I had a handful of pictures of him in disguise, which was kind of to relax everybody. And he's laughing and he likes his pictures. I said, so I'm going to show you the latest, greatest, best thing we've got. And I said, I'll take it off. And I started, and he said, well, no, don't take it off. Whatever it is, don't take it off. And he walked out around my chair and he's looking and he's peering and he's trying to figure out, is it a fake nose? He didn't know what I had on. Then he sat down, he said, okay. Took off my mask and held it up so that he could see it was light as a feather. It was
the great reveal. It was
just, hey, beautiful.
Jonna, we're gonna get to the history of your career. I mean, there's so much here. We've got plenty of time with you, which is great. But I'm just curious, how much, if masks were that good in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when you did this, how much better is the technology now?
Well, isn't that a good question? Because for many, many years, I never talked about masks. They were considered truly classified. And then it changed, and we can discuss masks. I'm not really sure how that worked. It makes me think that they are no longer classified, or they wouldn't let me talk about them. And that makes me think that we no longer use them.
Why do you think that would be?
Or at least we don't use the same thing that we were using then.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Well, what, if let's say we don't use them anymore, why wouldn't we use them anymore? Is it because of biometrics and they've just gotten so good you
It'd
can't
be
really
because,
fool someone?
Yeah, because of cyber, because of the incredible technological surveillance that's out there now, this ubiquitous technical surveillance everywhere all the time. Different materials react differently to different light sources. So under IR, it might look good. Under ultraviolet, it might look like a dandelion. You don't know. I don't know. But the fact that I can talk about them tells me that they are no longer, perhaps.
How did you get your book? How did you get your book past the folks who, I don't want to call them censors, but the approval process?
The Publication Review Board.
Yeah. How'd you get your book past them?
Well, you cross the fingers on both of your hands. You remind them that by statute, it should be a 30-day review. It's never a 30-day review. And you just kind of distract yourself because it can take 6 months for them to finish, you know, looking at it. And they come back and they say, there are some things here that are still classified and we're asking you to take them out. And this is our fifth book. We take them out. We don't want to put classified material in our books. It's not a light touch, but it's not nearly as severe as it used to be.
Jenna, I think when we think CIA or a woman working in CIA, and I know it's not apples to apples, but for me, I'm like, is it Homeland? Is it like Homeland? Like, you know, you're running and you've got guns and you've got money and you've got all this. Like, what is it really like?
Well, you won't like my answer because I didn't watch much of Homeland.
All right.
The woman, Claire Danes.
Yes, yeah. Claire Danes.
She irritated me so much I couldn't keep watching.
I will say,
watch The Americans.
Okay.
Give it another chance, though. It's a good show.
Okay. But all right, so you watched The Americans. So, but what was it like to be a woman in the CIA?
Well, it was hard. If you wanted to be in the operational piece of it, now, there were other parts of CIA where women had made good inroads. The analytical part of it that women did wonderfully as analysts, science and technology. If you had a degree in chemistry or physics or optics or whatever, we would hire you. We would hire you at a lower grade than the men, but we would bring you in. But in operations, it was, that's overseas, that's feet on the ground, that's meeting with the foreign targets or the foreign assets if they agree to work with us. People who are truly often risking their lives to work for American intelligence. And the men just had this firmly fixed idea that those people didn't want to be working with women, that they wouldn't, that in many cultures, women have no credibility, that have no value. And they said, we can't put you out in the middle of that. It was this kind of big, it was vague, it was sort of menacing. It was like the women. Well, yeah, I can't say what I said to them here on radio, but I said BS. That's not true. These men, it's always men. It was always men. These men are risking their lives.
What would you say? We've got about a minute, and then we'll take a break and come back. But what would you say women bring to the table that men don't in this kind of situation? And again, we've got about a minute, and then we'll come back and continue.
Well, in that scenario, women have an empathy that I think men don't necessarily carry around in their hip pocket. The men are interested in training this foreigner in whatever the technology is that they're going to report to us. And they're very focused on the mechanics of that thing. Well, I can do the mechanics as well, but I can also, I don't hold their hand, but I can reassure them. I can talk to them. There's a soft power that women can bring to these scenarios that has real value. And I discovered over time it has really good value. I found myself a couple of times retraining people. You know, if I'm showing someone how this gadget works, and if he doesn't get it right away, he has no problem saying to me, a woman, can we run through that again? Whereas if it's one of my male colleagues doing the same training, he gets done, he says, got it? The guy is going to say, yeah, I got it.
Oh, interesting.
And maybe he didn't get it.
I want to go back to how much of, your career in the CIA were you, in an office or meeting with, an agent or a source or something. I mean, were there moments where you really were in danger? I'm just curious about that, because I think I hear CIA and I know there's different levels, but I'm just curious about your own, since you were in some pretty serious spots, over the last few decades. Yeah.
I was in some situations that were certainly uncomfortable. I was in some situations that I think you would call dangerous. Not all the time. It didn't happen frequently, but when it happened, I had so much training that I had a very good sense of what I ought to do. Not that it would always work, but what I should try. That's a very vague answer to a kind of general question. There was some danger there. Mostly there was not. Mostly.
Well, but it's so interesting, because I think you guys, when we talk to someone like you, we get a peek into what the CIA is like and what goes on behind the scenes. And there's layers, right, in terms of gathering, deciphering, and, utilizing intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, the whole job is to bring back the information to American policymakers so they can make smart decisions. Information on the plans and intentions of our enemies. Now, if you just glance around the world right now and wonder, what is Putin planning? What are the Chinese going to do next? What about those Koreans with their nuclear missiles? You can imagine the kind of intelligence that our policymakers wanted and needed. Our job was to go find it, to find people who were conduits to that information, who could get it for us. We had all kinds of technology that we used. We had all kinds of tools that we could train them in. We had methods of their communicating that information to us, where we didn't have to meet face to face, which would really put them in danger. Typically, if we worried about danger, we worried about our foreign assets. They were the ones who were sometimes risking everything to work for us for a variety of reasons. It wasn't always money. They weren't always asking to be paid. A lot of them would work for us just for the promise that we would get their kids out of their country, get them to the West, get them educated over here. The motivators were always interesting. But whatever was involved to get the information was what we were about.
Jonna, can you talk to us a little bit about Argo? Because as I was doing research about you, I was struck that you co-wrote, along with your late husband, Antonio Mendez, a book about the hostage crisis.
Canadian and, caper.
Yeah, what exactly happened in 1979, 1980 in Iran? And your late husband's role, who, by the way, was portrayed by Ben Affleck in the film.
Yes, he was.
Take us back. I mean, I don't know what you were doing at that time, but what can you tell us about that whole experience, that whole event?
I had nothing to do with Argo when it happened. I was working in the same office, but because compartmentation is what it is, I didn't even know that it had happened.
Wow.
Wow, that says a lot, right?
They started making that movie 19 years later, which, just to point it out, Tony kept that secret for 19 years, and he never intended to tell that story. George Tenet, the head of CIA, directed him to tell the story to the New York Times. It was a moment in history when it was quiet. People were questioning, did we even need a CIA? And George Tenet, I think, very wisely decided to tell one good story of showing the value of the organization. Tony was gonna go to his grave with that story. It was remarkable. When we got the call in the middle of the night that said George Clooney's gonna buy the story, the rights to the story, the next morning over coffee, Tony said, you know what that means? It means we gotta write the book, because they'll move the story around, they'll change things a little bit. It won't be exactly 100%. And so we did that. We wrote the book, they wrote the script. And it's kind of interesting to compare them. The heart of the story is certainly there, but small things like Tony was never separated from his first wife. Tony had three kids, not one. So his other two kids are still angry about that because they didn't get to be in the movie. Nobody chased an airplane down a runway in a Jeep with a gun. They added that for just a little flourish at the end. The story in the middle of going in and getting those six American diplomats and bringing them out, that's what happened. And, you know, we were in touch with, and I'm still in touch with, all of them. We call them the house guests. They still, every once in a while, something comes up. We write notes back and forth. Who's doing what? Tony probably saved their lives. And it was just a moment. It was one, when he did it, it was just another operation. And it turned out to be so much more.
Unbelievable. Did you ever get to go to the set? Meet Clooney, Pitt?
Yes. Yes.
What was that like?
The opening scene where they're in the embassy and they're trying to shred those documents and things up. And everybody's, that took place at an abandoned VA hospital outside of LA. I mean, that's how they do it. And when we drove up to that, hospital, everybody was outside having a cigarette break. They were the actors, not the real people, the actors, but they were so closely modeled after the real people that Tony said they're, you know, he called them out one by one. There's Jessica, there's,
wow.
You knew who they were just from their clothes and their makeup and their hair. It was cool.
We just got 30 seconds. We could obviously, we wish we had longer, but we don't. 30 seconds. What do you hope someone who reads your book kind of takes away? And just quickly, forgive me.
I hope it's a different look inside of the CIA. It tells you day to day what you might be doing, what kinds of operations you were supporting, what the pressures were, what the dangers were. It's a very realistic look at, from a woman's point of view, doing the work. What was it like? And what was it worth?
Well, it's not we just, thank you for
it's
that.
It's not just for women.
It's not what?
It's not just for women. No. A lot of men are going to enjoy reading this book.
Well, we appreciate getting a peek into your life and your career and a peek into the CIA. Jonna, thank you so much. Jonna Mendez, former CIA officer. Her new book is called In True Face, A Woman's Life in the CIA Unmasked. And she was joining us there from Reston, Virginia. You're listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, Tim Stanovic. This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
It is Bloomberg Business Week. Carol, we've talked a lot this month about companies and climate change, thanks to the recent SEC approval of climate disclosure requirements for public companies. A quick reminder for everybody.
Yes.
The SEC will now force companies to disclose their greenhouse gas emissions for the first time, but the regulator is not going to force companies to quantify pollution from their supply chains or customers. That's known as Scope 3 emissions. We talked about it a lot on the program. Critics to the SEC rule who have said that it hasn't gone far enough. Pushed back on
supply chains are so important, right? And the impact that they have certainly on the environment. After all, carbon dioxide emissions are on track for one of the biggest increases in record this year, pushing the planet closer to catastrophic climate change. That jump, the result of human-induced pollution, plus the El Nino weather pattern, which weakens the ability of the world's natural carbon to sinks to absorb CO2. This is according to a forecast by the UK's Met Office. But our next guest is thinking a lot about sustainability.
Yeah, and the role that businesses play when it comes to climate change. Judith Visa is a global sustainability officer of Siemens. It's the $152 billion market cap engineering, manufacturing, and tech company based in Munich. She's here in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Judith, how are you?
I'm really well. Hello, you both.
Hello, hello.
So we'll get to all the nitty-gritty in a minute, but just thinking big picture here, like in a world where there's so much bad news about climate, over and over again, Carol and I are hit with it. We're almost desensitized to it. Although we would argue that we're seeing the actual implications of it more and more
Yeah, absolutely.
In our days. How do you think about the position that you have at a company that, you know, when we think about CO2 and we think about carbon emissions, industry is responsible for a lot of it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, industry accounts for about 29% globally. Add buildings to that, that's another 40%. You know, think transport, and then you're almost there.
It's almost the whole pie.
That's almost the whole pie. And we have enabling technologies that help from a decarbonization, resource efficiency in all of these areas. We work with industrial customers to digitalize, automate their manufacturing, think about product design and process design differently. But we also help with managing buildings and grids to decarbonize those, attribute to energy efficiency. And of course, we're building trains. Yeah? And what better ways of transport to decarbonize the world than to get people to use trains.
Well, and as we said, I'm looking at our supply function on the Bloomberg when it comes to your company. You've got, at least based on ours, I think it's like basically some of your biggest suppliers, some 102 customers. I'm sure there's a lot more. But again, I think it's kind of your major on both the inputs and the outputs, if you will. Having said that, what really moves the needle in your view when it comes to when you work with companies, when it comes to sustainability, and how do we get to a point where we think about, let's not create the bad stuff so that we don't have to somehow cover or, you know, kind of factor it out?
Well, first of all, I think that transparency around data is actually a huge advantage. Yeah? And we can talk a long time about...
But if we're missing the supply chain, is that a problem?
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Of course, okay. Of course. I mean, the scopes are there for a reason. And we're a signator of science-based targets. We wouldn't have signed that if we didn't believe that all the scopes were important. And we happen to be one of those enterprises that are actually not very energy intense in scope 1 and 2. But for us, supply chain is important. Huh? We've got 65,000 tier 1 suppliers alone, which is quite complex for an enterprise our size because of the many different things that we do from a technology perspective. So that is important. And then, of course, also how our products deliver downstream, yeah, scope 3 downstream. But for us, it's also important to understand and help our customers understand what we can do for them in terms of abatement. So last year alone, we probably attributed about 190 million tons of abated emissions, avoided emissions with customers.
Away with them.
And if I give you the other number for supply chain, that's around about a 10 million tons. So even though it's a little bit comparing apples with pears, but just to give you the magnitude of the challenge, you know, in terms of who we are in terms of our supply chain, but also what the technology can do for our customers.
How did you view the SEC ruling earlier this month? Does it, in your opinion, not go far enough? I mean, how did we look in comparison to the EU, for example?
Well, we're a DAX-listed company, so we're listed in Germany, yeah, so therefore the SEC ruling doesn't affect us directly. Yeah, but in Europe, and I'm sure you know that very well, the regulatory requirements are huge, yeah, are much, much bigger than anywhere else at this stage.
So what's your view on how it looks in the US? I mean, is it kind of just like we're not even catching up?
Well, I think every country needs to find their own way of you know, either sending positive signals, and I think with the Inflation Reduction Act, you have done a lot in terms of positive investments into clean energy and clean technologies. I think the EU has a reputation for being heavier on the regulatory side versus actually helping from an investment perspective. Mm. I think both is needed. Mm. I think both is needed at the end of the day.
What holds it back, Judith? I mean, I grew up where there were solar panels on homes and they were taken down because they didn't sell. I'm just curious, what is it that is taking so long in terms of the transition and being better in terms of the output that still impacts the environment in a negative way? I mean, I'm thinking about coming off our summer here where we had orange skies, right? And just, you know, I don't need to do the list. You're very much aware of it. Anybody who's a global citizen is aware of what's been going on, and it's different. So how do we move quicker, and why don't we?
Million-dollar question, because one of the good news, bad news facts is that the technology to get us much more safely into 2030 is already there. It just needs rapid deployment.
So
why are we not doing it? Yeah. So I would say different reasons. One is, if I go Europe in comparison to the US, the cost of energy is probably twice as high in Europe as it is here. Was even higher, you know, when war in the Ukraine broke out. So the return on investment into anything that helps from an energy efficiency perspective, of course, is huge in Europe. Yeah, so the business case for investing into that is a better one than here. On the other hand, I think there are a lot of companies also here in the US who basically take their responsibility very seriously and are trying to do the right things when it comes to climate change. And then there is a lot of customers of ours who are in business to consumer, no? And of course there is a lot of change in the perception of consumers around products that they would or wouldn't buy. So, but I think all of these things take time, and time is what we actually don't have. And so therefore, I think there is also a role to play for governments and community, you know, whether that's at a community level or at a national level, to actually set the tone in terms of either the regulatory side and this is obviously much preferable, yeah, in terms of inducing an investment.
Penalty tax, whatever, right? To kind of get us, you know, why do people have, you know,
or incentives. Say
what? Right, or incentives.
Incentives,
exactly.
Yeah.
Good point, the positive side of
the
it.
The positive side of things.
2024, an election year here in the U.S. I think it's fair to say that the current president, President Biden, has a different view on climate change and sustainability than the presumptive nominee, former President Donald Trump. Does it matter to you as Global Sustainability Officer at Siemens, who the president of the U.S. is?
Well, I mean, of course, it is important, you know, who some of the big players are around the globe, huh? And we face a geopolitical situation that is very different to just 5 or 10 years ago. But look, as Siemens, we've been here for 160 years. Yeah, for 160 years, we have worked with, you know, the elected parties and the policymakers, and for us, I think that's at the end of the day the most important thing. It's policy, not politics. Yeah, and we will work with.
We've talked a lot about the difference of that over the last couple of weeks, but forgive me. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, and so I think for us it's more that. Yeah, what's going to happen going forward, and at the end of the day we're all in business, and I think we will do what makes business sense. And there is in many regards also a business case for sustainability. Mm. I think we've seen that through a lot of bipartisan support as well.
All right. Great to have you here. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Judith Visa, she's Global Sustainability Officer at Siemens, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. You're listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, Tim Stenovic, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.